Well, and thank you to Chief Justice Perry for allowing me to be the Chief Justice presiding over this argument, which is my last oral argument as an active Supreme Court Justice. I also want to take the opportunity to thank the entire appellate staff, both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court staff. I'm just shy of about 8 years here at the appellate courts, and all of the staff, the attorneys, everyone, and most of all my colleagues, I want to thank for being so gracious and wonderful all of these years. So with that, we'll start argument, and we will start with the appellant. Would you like to reserve any rebuttal time?
Please, 5 minutes.
All right. Whenever you're ready to begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, everyone. My name is, may it please the court, my name is Ryan Basher. I was the trial attorney in this matter, here along with Mr. William Waters, who was the attorney on the briefs. As you could probably determine from the briefs and the issue before us is a Confrontation Clause issue. And I would submit as basic law 101, that it's a fundamental constitutional right. And I do realize, as we've submitted in our briefs, that it's not an absolute right, but when exceptions are made to this fundamental right, they must be necessary to further an important public policy. And that determination needs to be made by the district court in a case-specific finding. And if they do make that finding, they must assure that the testimony could be obtained reliably under proper circumstances. Unfortunately, the entire world was hit with a pandemic that caused some extraordinary circumstances in every facet of our lives, including the ability to try jury trials. And they were even forced into a pause for quite a period of time. However, the 8th Judicial District Court, along with guidance from, I believe, this court, attempted as safely and as quickly as possible to resume jury trials, as we know that we don't want unnecessarily to delay and we don't want people unnecessarily detained. They then, the district court, performed an order that was narrowly tailored under certain circumstances to effectuate the ability to return to trying cases. And specifically, in regards to the confrontation, it's far different than, say, your average status check. Status checks are certainly important. We're apprising the court of what's the status, what we need to do, where we're at, that sort of thing. But those things can be effectuated fairly easily thanks to the advances in the technology that we've been utilizing. But under this narrowly tailored order, it explicitly states to the extent possible, those people that are vulnerable under CDC guidelines, and they give examples, being over the age of 65, pregnant, or have an underlying health condition, should be accommodated when possible. The state, in this case, pretrial, moved to have two witnesses testify.
Well, wait a minute. The order doesn't stop there.
It does not.
There's some other words.
Sure.
That
it's actually, I agree, a very thorough order.
I think what you're talking about is on page 14 of the order, but if I'm wrong, let me know. The sentence that's applicable relating to trials in the administrative order, as I understood it, addresses district court judges should, to the extent possible, accommodate requests to appear by alternative means for any attorney, party, or witness who is considered a vulnerable person under current CDC guidelines, or to appear by alternative means for any other reason deemed appropriate by the court.
I agree. That's the complete writing of the, and I think that's where we then get into the absence of the case-specific finding in the situation.
So I was asked by my colleague, that's page 14 of the administrative order, which I believe was referenced 2104. Are we on the same page?
Yes.
Okay, and that is at line 21 or 20 through 23.
Yes, correct. So with that sentence in mind, then, we would then need to look to the case-specific finding made by the district court, which was not done here. Yeah. She summarily granted the state's request. And we're then...
It appears from the record that the two witnesses at issue were not allowed to participate by video because of COVID-related reasons.
Correct.
Yet... there did appear to be some other reasons offered by the state, and the question is whether or not those reasons, in my mind, whether those reasons fit within the AO, but more importantly, also satisfy the constitutional confrontation elements.
I agree, Your Honor, that if that's the that your point of emphasis.
That, for me, is my right. issue.
And then I would look to... what the United States Supreme Court and other jurisdictions have found as insufficient reasons, as we delineated in our brief, and that includes things such as inconvenience, added expense, and efficiency even, mm-hmm. Are things that have been found in the past to not meet the necessary public interest. Mm-hmm. And I would submit that while I'm sure this is disputed in the briefs that we've used the word, quote, inconvenience, I don't think it's an inaccurate summary of the reasons delineated both in the request in the first place and the reasons given when I was objecting at trial. I think we all understand that even pre-COVID, trials in general are inconvenient for a lot of folks, especially in a state such as ours that relies so much on tourism and people coming in and out. Victims, being victims of crimes from all over the world, yet we've always made it an important policy to bring them in, regardless of expense, regardless of work schedules, regardless of child care issues. It's no different than the 12 jurors that had to sit through this trial. I'm sure that they've had to make, especially during COVID, had to make extraordinary accommodations to be able to participate in the trial. The major difference, obviously, between the juror and these two witnesses is the travel. I submit that that is inconvenient and was especially inconvenient under COVID, but I would submit that, again, and I don't mean to be flippant with the word inconvenience, but I think it's fair summary of the reasons given by the state here.
I was going to sort of switch gears and talk about... in deciding whether it's if we agree that there was error, whether it's harmless. And there's some interesting discussion in this case because the state argues, look, we were calling this witness, but the witness is actually more helpful for the defense than for us. And there's, I guess my question is, in deciding whether it's harmless error, do you weigh the fact that these witnesses testified remotely as opposed to what if they hadn't testified at all? Or do we weigh it against what if they were forced to come testify in person, I guess, and could we force them? But I guess that's a separate issue. Talk to me about how we would weigh harmless error.
I think under the situation, and although we didn't have a case-specific requirement, I would submit that it would be under the circumstances of what happened here, that they were granted the ability to testify remotely and the circumstances as they were. I mean, to be frank, I wasn't thrilled that I lost my objection to the request to begin with, but when we were in court and things started going haywire,
right.
It was very bizarre to experience someone getting up and moving around and that sort of thing. As to the favorability to us, I would submit that's a matter of perspective, and I don't want to toot my own horn, but obviously, when confronted with a witness who's going to identify him as a killer, who's going to have the blood and that sort of thing, what do I do as a defense attorney? I have to spin this in a way that can be helpful. So I'm asking questions about his demeanor. I'm asking questions about him being in a hurry and And the statement that he makes, I'm not going to use, it's a swear, you know, saying, look, I just, she took me too far. You know, just let them know that she took me too far. So, yeah, obviously, as a defense attorney and someone who is confronting a witness under the Constitution, I am going to do the best I can to get whatever positive information I can out of it. Now, obviously, and I believe my colleague in the briefs submits that, so if, let's say she didn't testify, then now I have my client up there with a self-serving statement talking about what happened in that car with no cooperation whatsoever. And
did you make any efforts, counsel, to, or your, did your client make any efforts to bring the witness in? Did you independently subpoena the witness? Did you, you know, try to do those things? Because that's a witness obviously equally available to some extent to the defense.
Correct. And the answer is no, I did not. And my reason is, as I'm not the accuser or the prover, and I'm not going to bring in a witness who, while I do submit, I was able to get some positive things from, very much so, was a very important witness, I would submit, for the state. I mean,
and dovetailing into that, how would you distinguish your supplemental authorities when it comes to the Brown case? Because obviously our panel had a similar situation to more of like a custodian of records type of witness versus this witness.
Well, it's kind of similar to what happened here. In Santana, the witness Santana, he was a custodian of excuse me, I'm having a brain.
Brown, we just had it on, it was on deceptive trade practices and bringing in a witness that could take information off a cell phone and it basically just duplicate the information for Metro.
And that's essentially, I guess, I'm not very familiar with Brown, Your Honor, but I can submit that in this case.
He just filed supplemental points and authorities on it, Mr. Waters did.
I'm sure he did, knowing Mr. Waters. But I am, like I said, unfamiliar. But what I can, similar to your point, is in this case, there were two witnesses that were noticed to have testified via alternate means. One was, he was there, he put cones down, he, you know, said, okay, go talk to the detective. He wasn't all that important, and his appearance via alternate means wasn't as chaotic at all. It was brief and quick and that sort of thing. So I do agree that, you know, maybe going back to Judge Kadis' question, that this should be a case-specific question because you do have an example in this case where my objection probably isn't as strong as to Santana as it is, I would submit, to Marshall.
No, I was going to ask him if he wanted to save some of his time. But.
Oh, I did.
Well, you can, you're the presiding, you can always grant him more time. Like, counsel, just quickly, I want to kind of hone in because time is precious. So there's three issues. There's no findings. So now we've got a conviction. We come forward, is this harmless? And it seems that what I'm hearing from you is there's two issues now. One is the nature of that witness and that testimony. And two, at least as I gleaned through the briefs, that there were substantial audiovisual problems. Interference, hard to hear, those type of things, because we're trying to make a harmless error determination. So I need you, if you can really hone in on why with that witness it wasn't harmless. Is it because of both of those issues? Is it because of the nature of her testimony?
I believe it's a combination of both, but primarily the nature of her testimony. And I mean, I would submit a line from the respondent's brief. As a result of the physical evidence at both scenes, Marshall's description of what occurred, the victim being dead, based on that information, Detective Owens generated an arrest warrant. And so with that, I'll reserve my remaining time, please.
May it please the Court, Alexander Chen on behalf of the respondent, State of Nevada. A number of questions were just raised about what happened here, and I think having seeing the evolving case law that we have in this area, really Lipsitz and then Brown are relatively recent cases. Lipsitz actually comes right before the pandemic, and then coincidentally or subsequently Brown is issued, and we get to examine this confrontation clause issue with regards to video audiovisual testimony. But when we look at essentially what Maryland versus Craig has told us, and then Lipsitz has told us, is we look to the two prongs of whether there was public reason or an important reason to have this exception, and then we look to whether there was reliability associated to it. The COVID-19 pandemic has been recognized by this court. It was in Chaparro that we recognized these are unprecedented times. And my concern, although I will admit state fault here in terms of the request that we made and the objection that counsel made, our request for using these testimony was inadequate. I'm going to go ahead and put forth that right now. It was inadequate. I think that because this was new and because we all just assumed because of the COVID pandemic we could use audiovisual testimony, perhaps the administrative order was not as closely looked at as it should have been. However, when you look at what the objective facts are in this case, when you look at what the court made a record of in terms of allowing the testimony, I think that the court put forth the public policy interest that we're dealing with things that we've never dealt with before. We're trying to protect the health and well-being of not only the witnesses, of our staff, of anybody who enters the Regional Justice Center.
What evidence is there, what evidence is there of a threat to these two witnesses' health and safety that's different than any other witness?
I think, though, Justice Kadish, when we start to ask those questions, the difficulty becomes, as we saw, there was different sensitivities to COVID-19 throughout the country, throughout individuals.
What evidence is there that they had particular sensitivities?
Well, I think here at least you have a lady who just had a baby. And again, it wasn't put into the reason that we requested it. But it did come out that she was a recent mother. And the as I think just in
did
terms
that
of...
that come out, sorry, during her testimony?
It did. It came out, and the court made findings of it when the court, I can reference it, actually. The court makes it in Appendix 4, around page, around 807. She talks about her daughter just waking up, and the court makes additional findings, I believe, up till 829, Justice Kadish. But it is something that was discussed, that that was a concern. I know it was raised by the state, and it was taken into account by the court as well.
But, Mr. Chin, at the time you had the hearing on the state's motion to have these witnesses testify remotely, I think the state had said, hey, we invited them. They're not on the Zoom. There really was no the proffered reasons were convenience.
Yes.
I that's fair to say. Convenience in and of itself probably doesn't pass muster, and that's not where we are, because now we're in the harmless area.
Yes.
Tell me why it wasn't harmless.
Because I think you look...
I'm sorry. Tell me why it was harmless,
yes,
given both, and I don't want necessarily the officer, but on the key witness, both because of even the nature of the video problems, coupled with the environment, coupled with you don't know who's in the room or whatnot, and her role in the case. Why in this, it is facts, you know, dependent, why in this unique confluence of events is this harmless?
I think there's two reasons. Because when you're looking at the reliability factor, prong two of Lipsitz, we can see in this case that, one, the answers that they needed came out. What was that witness going to help them provide? And the evidence that that witness talked about was basically how the defendant was agitated, was frustrated, and he made this statement that he had had enough. He couldn't take any more. Those were the key points of that person's testimony. This wasn't a contentious cross-examination. I would submit to you that if we had a witness where there were some technical difficulties, but because of the difficult nature of cross-examination that the defense attorney couldn't properly cross them because of these technical issues, that would be one instance. But this is harmless because every piece of information that they wanted to come out actually came out in this particular trial. And not only that, Justice...
But it was your witness. The state called the witness.
I understand. And the witness testified, but my point is, why is it harmless? And I think it's harmless because they were able to get all the information, the defense was, that they wanted. And not only that, I think it's also harmless that in this case, unlike the first case, you had the defendant give his version of testimony. So you have the defendant.
But how do you know that you're calling that witness and the judge permitting this and whatever went on in direct in terms of the jury watching this didn't force their hand
to do things in their cross-examination or presentation of their case that was influenced by this. I mean, that's a very hard position for you to be arguing, well, it wasn't harmful because it actually helped them.
Well, I think because in this case, we have the fortune of also knowing that this was not the first trial and not the first time that they cross-examined her. When she was present at the first trial, if you look at the questions that were asked, they're the exact same questions. She's giving the exact same responses. This is not a witness who substantially changed her testimony, nor is this a witness who the questions were incredibly different from the first trial to the second trial. So I don't think that there's any evidence that they didn't get the cross-examination that they wanted out of this particular witness.
But even if they got some information that they wanted from this witness, doesn't that make it more important to have that witness come in person then? I mean, this is a murder trial, and they were forced to cross-examine this witness on a video where audio's going in and out, a baby's walking in and out of the room, and she's walking around the apartment.
Well, I believe that the district court judge in this said she didn't see a baby in the video, just so we're clear. And the district court also asked, make sure there's nobody in the room with you. Obviously, a little baby might have been an exception, but there was no one feeding her answers. My point, though, is it's harmless because when you look at the progression of this case, when you look at what the defense was, when you look at the prior trial, everything that was needed came out in this trial.
I have a question to ask in line with what I had asked defense counsel about Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And you're familiar with that.
Yes.
And in that case, same thing, district court judge didn't make any types of finding. We found that was error. In that particular case, though, we found it to be harmless. But I think Justice Pickering's concurrence in that about the confrontation clause is well-founded. And how do we look at this case when you have the state and what defense just argued here? You know as a DA, probably half your cases from Vegas are tourist-related or out-of-state witnesses. And if you had a dime for every time somebody said, I'm not coming back, you'd be a rich man. Okay. Right?
Every time
you've been on the phone, like it happens every day, it's daily.
Absolutely.
And you have to tell them this is not like a involuntary thing, you're coming.
Yes.
Right? Material witness, warrant, whatever, you tell them they're coming. What in the future, if this is allowed in this type of case, what stops this from happening in every criminal case, murder or otherwise, just because a witness is somehow inconvenienced that they're not going to use a videotape?
I agree, Justice Silver. I don't think that we can discount the COVID-19 pandemic in this particular case because that's the reason that the court, especially in this case, was, I think it gave a lot of weight to the pandemic as to why we did this.
How do we know that? Because it's not in their order.
It's not in the order, but it's in the record because the court says we are living in unprecedented times right now. It is not ideal that we have to do this. It is not ideal that I am granting this. However, based upon the administrative order, based upon everything else that's going on right now, this is just something that might be the new norm for a while.
Well, Mr. Chin, in point of fact, courts all over the United States are conducting criminal jury trials by video in numerous instances. And a lot of the jurisprudence surrounding the Confrontation Clause and its limitation to convenience or exclusion of convenience, are cases that were decided before the pandemic, where courts were less tolerant to an inconvenience as an excuse. The Conference of Chief Justices has recently held a conference in which there's a complete examination about the use of AV technology in criminal jury trials and other court proceedings. This perhaps is a cutting-edge case where convenience is appropriate. So what I'm concerned about here is, since the findings appear to be inadequate on the question of COVID, and it does seem to be the focus of the judge's position that the convenience of the witnesses would be accommodated, why is that a Confrontation Clause violation? I'm not sure that it is.
Well, Justice Hardesty, I think it's because it is a new area with regards to COVID, but just from following the past cases, that's when they start examining whether this audiovisual communication is permitted or not. Certainly, it's our position that, especially because of COVID-19, it's something that should be admissible.
My point is that in the future, the judicial system as a whole is changing in many, many ways. And if a witness can participate in a proceeding from another jurisdiction effectively, and the testimony that they provide and the information that is supplied is consistent, and there's no showing that there's been any prejudice because the testimony was inadequate or the reliability of the witness was a problem, none of which I've seen argued here, then I'm not so sure that convenience isn't an appropriate exception.
Certainly, on behalf of, I'm sure, the prosecutors in the state, Justice Hardesty, if that becomes the rule, we would certainly allow it. I'd have a lot less dimes in my bank account, as Justice Silver was making reference to. But certainly, it's this court's prerogative to decide how far and what, if anything, is going to be a confrontation clause issue. But I can certainly and definitively...
Don't we have to follow what the U.S. Supreme Court says about the federal confrontation right?
Yeah, I think so, Justice Kadish, but certainly there's going to be carve-out exceptions to that as well. And I, just based on looking at this case, and I would actually just also point out that the other witness that was objected to, the officer who was in California, again, not a great reason that we put forth the same thing, same problem there, but I would say there was no cross-examination even with regards to his testimony. The testimony came out in other places. So what my concern is if we're only putting... especially during a pandemic, if we're only putting these restrictions on because of this quote-unquote confrontation clause issue, but then at the end of the day, there's not even a confrontation, but simply making the objection is valuable, strategically valuable to the defense, that would be my concern, Justice Kadish.
It would have to be whether it's harmless or not, and it's frankly almost, maybe there is a concession as to the one witness, probably harmless, but... as to the other one, who I note was extensively discussed in our prior opinion on this case, sure, as to the importance of that witness, arguably not harmless. I mean, so let me ask you this. We still have COVID, right? It's still a thing. People are still getting it. Several of us got it just this summer. So does that mean now, are you arguing that you can bring any witness in by remote and that satisfies confrontation clause?
Well, I think it's still case-by-case basis, but Justice Kadish, what I think would be problematic is if we start making these carve-outs in a certain way, saying, we think that your concern about COVID is valid, but we think this witness, your concern about COVID, is invalid. Even though, as we've learned, everybody has their own tolerance level, everybody has their own concerns about this pandemic, but all of a sudden, we're going to allow certain people to testify, but enforce or we're going to allow some to do it remotely, but force others to have to come in and subject themselves to potential harm to themselves, harm to others. So as the order read, it talked about vulnerable people or, and I'm talking about the administrative order, sorry, not the court's order.
Okay.
But in the administrative order, as we talk about vulnerable people especially, okay, but we also
under CDC guidelines. Evidence is there that these witnesses were vulnerable under CDC guidelines?
The CDC guidelines have changed over time as well, Justice Kadish, and that's
sure,
our concern.
So at the time of trial.
But let's be real. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The witness didn't raise, this was not a witness-generated COVID issue. It was a convenience issue for the witnesses proffered by the state. And the court had a generalized observation about, well, it makes sense to me because there's COVID. Is that a fair kind of observation?
I would say, based upon what was filed, yes, Justice Stiglitz. Okay. But there was the concern about the baby that I think is in the record.
Okay. Confrontation is, can I, meaningfully, question these people? But with your proffer, so if the defendant's going to testify and the sheriff says, it's really inconvenient for us to bring him, let's just do video. Because the problem is not, you throw a rock in a pond, there's ripples.
Yes.
Nobody wants to come to court. Nobody wants to transport defendants to court. Where do we address that minefield? And if we're going to make a rule or understand this, are we to make a rule that considers the role of the witness in the case? the ability to not have confrontation interfered with by, you know, technologically or what? Like, what kind of guardrails do we put up so people aren't just jurors aren't coming in watching a TV show?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't there a value to having the body? Not to the exclusion of everything else, but just trying to conceptualize what that looks like.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there. I think, though, just if I could, if you take two exact, if you take a case and you have one witness who's incredibly COVID conscientious and concerned, and you have another witness who is not concerned at all, the defendant in one case is going to face a possible trial because this person is willing to come in for COVID. In the other situation, they potentially get a benefit simply because by the grace of some other power, that witness who needs to come into court because the court has deemed that under no circumstance can they testify auto-visual-wise is going to get a benefit because that person can't come into court. That person won't come into court. You look puzzled, but I mean, I think...
What's the benefit?
The benefit is that you don't have that person's testimony, that they refuse to come, that they don't show up.
Did they refuse to come? Was there a refusal of either of these witnesses to come, or did the state just run with the fact that it'd be hard to get them here?
I didn't say in this case, Justice Stiglitz, but
sure.
I was saying that in general,
sure.
If we start making it where we're questioning people's sensitivities to COVID, for, you know, which I think we all agree is a good reason,
sure.
We run into the problem that you have similarly situated defendants who are going to have a completely different result simply because they're lucky that one witness is refusing or can't come because of a COVID concern, even if they don't fit the definition of a vulnerable person. And that's what our concern would be. I think to answer your question ultimately, if I may, what Brown says, and Brown was relatively new, so I suppose it's not uncommon that the court and the state in this case didn't require the necessary findings. I know this court is favorable upon specific findings. I think this is one of those cases where if the court's going to decide on it, it is harmless, but again, admonishing, encouraging, and detailing what these specific findings need to be. I think, though, from the record and just from the nature of this case, it's enough to affirm the conviction.
Are there any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Chen. Oh, you did?
Can I ask just one more thing?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. I didn't hear. I thought you said no.
That's interesting. Sorry. So, Mr. Chen, if your position is, okay, in this instance, it's harmless, admonish, cajole, you know, whatever, what guidance are we giving them? So a judge now, some witness wants to not travel from New York or whatever, and a judge gets our opinion and they say, okay, here's what I'm supposed to do. What do we tell them? What do you think we should tell them?
Well, at least right now, if the answer is COVID-based, I think that needs to be put forth, that there is a sensitivity to COVID, and that could be their personal sensitivity. I don't think that it needs to be something where you're saying that they're absolutely a vulnerable person. But I would say that the facts need to be put on there. Here, I know we're kind of gleaning the facts from looking at the record in totality, but I think that, again, just the case-specific finding is needed. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to give 4 minutes to the appellant just to equal out the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to pick up where with Justice Hardesty and talking about the evolution of and how other jurisdictions have accommodated this sort of thing. And if that change, which I obviously am not conceding, is the wave of the future and those changes are going to be made, then remember Craig has two prongs. And the second prong of Craig, which says that after, a first prong would be a case-specific finding, we don't have that here, but the second prong of Craig would require that reliability be assured. And I can guarantee you, as a witness to this myself, it was chaos. There were 3 to 4 interruptions. The judge, myself, the state would have to leave the courtroom because we couldn't do a bench conference because blue jeans was left on. What happened in court while blue jeans was left on? I don't know. I wasn't there. We had instances where the state was trying to repeat the answers because the audio and video was going in and out. The smoke alarm was chiming. She's standing up and moved around. My first knowledge of the baby was it crying in the background. I would submit that even if we go down that road and find that there is this evolution, that then, as to Justice Stiglitz's question, is what do we do? What's the guidance we have to give? And that would have to be that assurance that there's some sort of reliability there.
Counsel, what evidence did you hope to obtain from this witness that you were unable to secure?
Well, we were thankfully able to secure, over objection, the statement that we were hopeful to get this defendant's statement, just know that, blah, blah, blah. So that was one fight we had. Other than that, in a very peaceful, piecemeal and very fractured fashion, we were able to get what we wanted. But I would remind Your Honor, and I know that this jurisdiction doesn't have quote-unquote stock instructions, but every one of the cases I've ever done in Nevada has the credibility instruction. And I would refer you to the appendix page 167, which is instruction 29 in this case, in which it says that the credibility or believability of a witness should be determined by his manner upon the stand. That was impossible to ascertain during that chaos.
Are you in agreement with Mr. Chin that the testimony offered by the witness was consistent with the testimony given in the first trial?
Yes. And to that end, Judge, and this is, I guess, absent other questions, how I'd like to wrap up, and it references what Judge Kadish asked about was the original opinion, is that this witness and this witness's credibility and this witness's information was critical in this case, because this wasn't a whodunit. This was the difference between a manslaughter and a murder. And that's a very technical argument that I was forced to have to make as lay people, and some lawyers, sometimes myself included, with the Brown case aren't, you know, as familiar or as cognizant with the law as they might should be. But it, beyond that difficulty of having to explain those differences, I was then, I submit, unable to adequately confront this witness. And given the fact that I believe this to be a case-specific inquiry under these circumstances, I believe that it was not harmless.
Do any of the justices have any other questions?
I don't think so.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.